It's a life story filled with unlikely facts. How does a baby girl born in 19th century Massachusetts become one of the first women to become a doctor in Oregon? And how did Portland society receive an openly gay mother 100 years ago? What about one who performed abortions without apology, who championed anarchist ideology, too? Dr. Marie Acqui challenges the mainstream currents of our time, let alone her own. This hour, we're going to dive more deeply into the life and legacy of this remarkable woman, known to most of her contemporaries as simply Doc. Our guest wrote a biography of Doc called Marie Acqui, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. He's a public historian who has chronicled movements for social justice and LGBT rights since the 1970s. Lately, he's devoted years of his life to preserving the details of Marie Acqui's life. Michael Hellquist, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks, Emily. I'm really happy to be here.
It's our pleasure to have you. Before we talk about Marie's life, as a biographer, you didn't have some of the sort of staple primary sources we think of, like her journals and papers. They didn't survive her after her death in 1952. How did you source a biography of her?
It took a lot of meticulous searching, and I was really fortunate to find quite a few collections that were previously unknown, and some of these were hiding, in a sense, in public records. So early on, I traveled to New Bedford, Massachusetts, where she grew up, and found in the Catholic Church that her family was a member of many of the records of her family, what were called the sacramental records, the baptisms, marriages, etc. So that helped me get more of a sense of her early life, and then also a number of letters that I found that documented her struggle working in the textile mills in New Bedford and how she was rescued so that she could come to the West and help settle a homestead. After that, other things were just serendipitous. I was lucky to find them. Others I really sort of scoured in archives and found much more.
So you've glossed a lot there. Marie, of course, was born to immigrant parents, an Irish mother, an Italian father, a working class family, and a large family. Several of the children died. And as you mentioned, her first job was in a textile factory. A friend helps get her into college. Why did she end up dropping out after just 1 year?
Well, her parents insisted on it. It wasn't usual for girls, sometimes even boys, to go to high school at all before going to work. Marie was able to go for 1 year, and then her parents insisted that she start working to help support the family. There were 11 children at the time, and so she had to drop out. She was bitterly disappointed. She really loved being in school. She started working in the textile mills and was there for 2 years, and then a school friend of hers, who was a few years older and came from a more well-off family, helped her leave the textile mill and gave her money to go to a private school in central Massachusetts. That's how she got out of the childhood labor trap.
And was she able to stay in school for very long?
No, there was only enough money from her friend for 1 year. So basically, she had the equivalent of 2 years of high school. And then she found another way through the same woman to come to Oregon and to start on a homestead outside the Dalles.
We're talking about Marie Acqui and the woman who helped her and probably sounds like made all the difference in her course in life, Bessie Bell Holcomb. Biographer Michael Hellquist is our guest. Michael, when you write of these years when Marie was friends with Bessie, the very early years, and undertaking that 1 year of college, there's a line in here that says, in the late 19th century, many all-women colleges explicitly supported students who became emotionally or physically engaged with one another. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, there has been quite a bit of documentation about this, about these relationships, this phenomenon, perhaps. And most of it centers on the traditional upper-class women's colleges on the East Coast. And so there, people have written about that before. Women who were in those relationships have written about them. They were called Boston marriages. And so that was fairly well established. But the difference for Marie was that these Boston marriages almost always involved women from a higher social level, economic level, and professional women. And Marie was neither. Her interest, Bessie Holcomb, was from a higher station, and Bessie actually went to Wellesley College before dropping out to come to Oregon.
And, of course, they will have a story unfold in Oregon. When you were looking at their relationship and at subsequent relationships in Marie Equy's life, how prevalent were the references to lesbianism or to gay men in the historical sources of this era?
Well, partly it depends where you're at geographically. The word lesbian really wasn't used in the United States commonly. Homosexuals weren't referred to as lesbians or gay, and even the word homosexual was not used at this time in the 1890s or early 1900s. But there would be, you know, euphemisms or maybe slang or terms of derision that were sometimes used.
Were they always derisive? I mean, did people in this community have a way of referring to themselves?
I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did have an understanding of, in the lower classes, I'm not sure what those terms were in the early days of this period. But, you know, people communicate, and they give off clues or ideas of where they are in their life and who they believe they are. So I'm sure there were.
We are looking at many of the clues left from Marie Equy's life, painstakingly gathered together by her biographer, Michael Hellquist. He's our guest. Phone number and email address are coming up, and much more discussion of Marie Equy's life after a short break here on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host today, Emily Curitan. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, join our discussion. You can do that by giving us a call, 800-838-3760, or drop your comments off to jx@jeffnet.org. Our guest is Michael Hellquist, author of a recent biography of Dr. Marie Equy, a medical doctor, suffragette, labor activist, and radical thinker of her time, that being the end of the 19th and the first half of the 20th century. You can join this discussion. And Michael, I want to move on to talking about Marie's life as it began to unfold in Oregon. Born in Massachusetts and then moves all the way across the country, she follows her in the footsteps of her slightly older, richer friend, Bessie, who came to Oregon to stake a homestead in 1891 as a single, unmarried woman. How unusual was this for a single woman to do?
It was unusual, but not completely uncommon, partly because there were already single women coming from the East to work, especially as school teachers. And there were a sizable number who also sought homesteads. And this was actually the first time in our nation's history where the U.S. government established a program under this homestead legislation that allowed single women to own land or to go through the process of homesteading to have title to the land. So it was a great opportunity for women who wanted to seek their own independence and strike out on their own.
And when these two women, Bessie comes and then Marie joins her not long after, how does Marie end up horsewhipping a reverend in the center of town?
That was a pretty sensational event. It was her first exposure to the public in Oregon and even beyond. So Bessie was a school teacher at a private school in the Dalles, and she had been hired for a certain amount of money. And then the superintendent of the school, who was also a Baptist minister, refused to pay her the full salary that he had promised. Bessie and Marie tried to negotiate over quite a period of time to get the money that was due them. It was worth about $100 in 1892. That was the value. And they finally ran out of patience, and Bessie was saying, I think we should get an umbrella. and I should just take the umbrella to him. And Equi said, no way, I'm getting a horsewhip. And she did. And she stalked in front of his office in downtown The Dalles, and there was only one way out of his office, and she dared him to come out. And she was cracking her horsewhip, as she did on this hot, dusty day in her long skirts. And finally he tried to escape, and she caught up with him and got a few good whacks in, and then he fought back. And then the townspeople, interestingly, rallied around Marie once they realized who she was going after, because he was considered a scoundrel in town involved in land fraud. And she was even proclaimed at the end of the day a queen for the day by one of the Dalles newspapers.
So the newspapers, it sounds like they looked upon this with interest and also with sympathy for Marie. I noticed one of the headlines was somewhat neutral, just flogged by a woman, which for me kind of summed up the incident there. Whatever happened to Reverend Taylor, the Baptist minister?
Well, he continued in his dealings. He was trying to set up a new community across the river, across the Columbia in Washington State, and he was promising investors back east, something that never existed out here. So he continued that. He got in more legal problems, and he just kind of dwindled on in a sense of not being able to make any of these investments work for him and getting involved in more litigation. Wasn't really heard from too much afterwards.
So after being the sort of the hand of justice in the Dalles, Marie and Bessie, they move on to San Francisco. They've secured a homestead in eastern Oregon, and Bessie marries. Bessie marries a man there in San Francisco. What's Marie's response to that?
Well, we don't know for sure because we don't have any written statements from her, but they did move to the Dalles, into San Francisco in 1897, and Marie had decided to self-study her way into medical school. So she was on a professional path going to medical school at first in San Francisco. And Bessie ended up becoming enamored with her boss at this leather manufacturing company in San Francisco. And they ended up getting married. So those two events were going on. They were both pursuing some, they continued living together but had other interests. I think that Marie also became closer to a woman student who was in class with her. Those two women ended up moving to Portland to continue their medical education. And after they left, Bessie married her boss. So, you know, inevitably, I think we can fill in some blanks there that there had to be some discomfort or adjustment at least for Bessie's new interest as well as Marie's.
And at this point in Marie's life, her medical education is really picking up steam, and that education will continue for a good deal of the rest of her life. Could you tell us about how doctors were trained in the West at this time, in the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, you know, it was really interesting. Marie Equi was very fortunate to apply for medical school when she did, because a teaching certificate or a high school diploma were not required to enter. All you had to do was pass an entry exam. So on the one hand, the standards or requirements for entry were low enough so that she could enter, but at the same time, the quality of medical education in the West was greatly improving, so she got the benefit of that. It was 4 years of medical school. Of course, the knowledge base that we have today was nothing like what they had to contend with there. The clinical care was much more limited because the medications were not available. But, you know, Oregon strived to stay up with the norm across the country in the medical education it provided.
And what year did she become a licensed medical doctor?
That was in 1903. She graduated from the University of Oregon Medical Department, which is today's OHSU in Portland.
And when did she and how did she become active in the movement for women's suffrage?
I think her first involvement was probably in 1906, because after she graduated, she did try a practice with her new woman companion in Pendleton, And although it worked well for Equi, it did not work so well for the other woman. So they returned to Portland, and that was in 1905. And that was right in the midst of yet another attempt for women to gain suffrage in Oregon. So she was naturally drawn to that, as many women were. And she had a position that she could leverage as a professional. And I think she really took advantage of that as far as the campaign was concerned.
How so?
Well, you know, you can get more attention in those times, maybe even now, in the newspapers, in the public paying attention to you, if you're a woman of stature, and any professional woman would have been at that time. So she had more opportunities to get her message out to others, and she did that. She wasn't one of the major players during the suffrage campaign, but she was a steady, dedicated worker who definitely spent a fair amount of time on it.
And we're talking with Michael Hellquist, author of a recent biography of Dr. Marie Equi. You can join this discussion 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Michael, Dr. Equi, she is licensed at the beginning of the 20th century at a time when abortion, as now, is quite controversial. How well known was it that Equi performed abortions?
I think it was known among her patients and the word of mouth from her patients to others. She was also involved in labor politics at the time and getting involved in labor demonstrations or strikes. So the word would have passed informally there. If someone needed reproductive services and care, they could go to Marie Equi. Also in the medical community, there were a number of doctors, maybe a handful of licensed physicians who were providing abortions, some full-time. Equi never did it full-time. And I think for Marie Equi, what the dynamic there was is that other doctors who would not provide abortions themselves would refer their patients to Marie because they trusted her. They knew she was discreet. They knew she was safe and skilled, and they knew that the patients could get their needs taken care of, and they hoped that the patients would then come back to them so that the referring doctor could keep their patient base. So in a way, they were depending on Marie Equi to assume all the risk for them.
And were abortions actually illegal in Oregon or in the U.S. at this time?
Yes. Yes, definitely. Although the first anti-abortion law was enacted in the 1860s, I believe, and the first abortion trial didn't happen until about 1875. And it was controversial, not like today. It was actually in the progressive era in the early 1900s in Portland, where some of the progressives wanted to curtail abortions because they were for reform and social control. And that's when there was sort of a spike in the number of abortion prosecutions, and it became more controversial, involving other members of the community. Marie Equi was never charged on any offenses related to abortion. None of her patients are known to have suffered in the sense of their health declined as a result of the abortions that she provided.
Did you find any documentation of why that might have been, if it was widely known that she was doing this, why the medical community in Portland turned a blind eye? Was that just typical there, or was she particularly well-liked?
There was some of both. Many doctors aren't going to turn in their colleagues, and they also realized that women were getting abortions and were going to get abortions whether there was a law against it or not, much like, you know, up to our times before abortion became legal. So the reality is women were seeking abortions, and many doctors who had the well-being of their patients in mind determined if they're going to get it, let's at least make sure that it's safe. So that's partly what was involved. And I think there was also an aspect of Marie Equi helped wealthier patients also. And, you know, that tends to trickle up in a sense that if you're helping the wife of the police chief, for example, that may protect you from any investigations in the future.
So in some of her medical work, Marie Equi flew below the radar. However, her name figures into two appeals court cases and a Supreme Court case. Can you talk to us about some of that?
Right. Well, there was one. So she was involved with another woman in Portland whose name was Harriet Speckert, who was the heir to the Olympia Brewing Company. And Harriet Speckert's mother was withholding her rightful inheritance from her. And it blew up, this argument among the family, blew up on the front page of the Sunday Oregonian in 1906. And there was a suggestion that Marie Equi, as an older professional woman, was basically, they were calling her a gold digger, trying to get after Harriet Speckert's money through this new relationship that they had formed. And so there was a scandal there. It was another example of one of Equi's intimate relationships with a woman becoming to public notice. And that court fight, it went to court, and the fight continued for years and years. Neither Harriet nor her mother or the family would just resolve it and let it go. It went on for years, and at one point, Harriet's litigation made it to the Circuit Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco, and Equi in those proceedings was referred to as a meddlesome outsider. And there were implications about the relationship that they had without being too specific. So that was one time when it happened. And then another time was Marie Equi's own case when she was fighting the sedition charges against her that were filed by the federal government for her giving a talk against World War I. She lost her case in the lower courts, and it went to the Court of Appeals, and she lost there. She submitted it to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they chose not to hear it.
Were you able to find many records of the government's efforts to surveil Dr. Marie Equi after she came out as an anti-war advocate and a labor advocate?
Yes. Interestingly enough, you mentioned at the start that there were few personal records or journals of Marie Equi's, but the trove of information that's the largest and most varied is what was documented by the U.S. government while she was under surveillance.
How many years was that?
They had at least a full year while they were preparing a case against her. Mm-hmm. They had 7 to 8 agents working on her case, which was considerable considering the United States was involved in World War I then, and there were certainly much greater risks, you would think, than this doctor in Portland. They also had an undercover agent stay with Equi during the day and report on her daily activities. So I was able to get, through the Freedom of Information Act, access to 800 pages of federal surveillance reports on Marie Equi. And then also, when she was imprisoned, there were copies of all of her prison correspondence.
Well, certainly labeled as a radical in her time, arguably would be in this time as well. When, you know, you must have gotten so close to her as a subject in writing this biography. It's quite exhaustive and very interesting. When do you most often think of Marie Equi's legacy today?
You know, it's ironic in a way, but I think of her looking at the headlines or hearing the news reports every day. And sometimes when people say, well, what's so special about Marie Equi? And I sometimes say, well, imagine someone who fights on the front lines for voting rights, reproductive rights, a living wage, affordable housing, and an overhaul of the criminal justice system. Marie Equi did all of that 100 years ago. So everything that many of the issues that we're so concerned with today and struggle with today, that's what she dealt with 100 years ago. So in those ways, it comes to my mind often. And then also, I am just aware of the sacrifices that activists, whichever side of an issue that you're on, but the sacrifices that activists make to follow their own mind and their own beliefs, the courage that it takes to put yourself out there and to be vulnerable, which she did repeatedly and suffered as a result of it.
Do you think she'd be impressed with our progress on the causes that she cared so much about and invested so much of her energy in?
She would, yes. I mean, certainly women have had the vote for 96 years as of today, coincidentally. Labor unions got much stronger in the years after her death, the decades. They're not as strong as they used to. Working conditions are much improved, and that was something that she fought for a lot. There's certainly more access to reproductive services that are now legal, although being more challenged today. So I think all of those things would have encouraged her, although she certainly would have reason to take pause and look at how much work remains to be done.
We've been talking about the life and legacy of Marie Acqui. The biography of her is called Marie Acqui, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. Our guest, Michael Hellquist, wrote it. And thank you so much for joining us today, Michael.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.